This is Australia Remembers tape number 11. This interview is recorded with Mr. Peter Carr, COWE of Cranbourne, on the 23rd of October 1995.
Well, I turned 17 in December 1941, and I got my father's permission, or he signed the papers for me to say I was 19 years of age, and I joined the army then, and I served in the 2nd 23rd Infantry Battalion up until August 1945, when I was discharged medically unfit. I don't look medically unfit now anyway, so I'm not very worried about it. It's a long time down the track that we left Australia in 42 and went over to the Middle East. And I joined the 2nd 23rd Battalion at El Alamein in the Western Desert, just as they turned Rommel's nose back the other way. We returned back to Australia on a beautiful ship, the New Amsterdam, with all the little luxuries that could be on board. And I think it was the biggest ship to ever come into Melbourne at that particular time. And we did the first, after we had a bit of leave, 3 weeks leave, I think it was the first march ever held in Melbourne by returned fellas from the Middle East in the World War II, but it was mainly organised to raise funds for a war loan. I think they launched the first war loan, and it was mainly to boost the public into putting a few bob into the war loan. But I always remember the march because it was very, very well done, and we did look pretty good, but they gave us a nickname that stuck and we didn't really like it. They called us the Glamour Boys because we looked pretty good. We didn't like that because, just didn't seem to suit infantry battalions to be called Glamour Boys, I don't think. After that, we went to Queensland and did some jungle training up on the Atherton Tablelands at Kirai. And then we went down to Cairns to Trinity Beach, which is now, I haven't been back there since, but I believe it's a flourishing suburb now with big high-rise buildings. But in those days, it was just a bay with all scrub around the beaches, and we camped in the scrub there, and it was the first time we'd met the Yanks. And the Yanks had landing boats there, and we did our invasion training there in preparation for the landing at Lae up on the Huon Peninsula in New Guinea. And the reason we were down there, the 7th Division was up on the Tablelands at the same time as the 9th Division, which we were in the 9th Division. And they weighed us all, and the lightest division had to go in by air to the Markham Valley, and the heaviest division had to go by sea. So we weighed in a bit heavier all up than them. So we had to do the training down on the beachhead at Cairns. From there they took us over to Milne Bay and just waited until the time was right to do the landings. I guess they had to get the right tides and different things like that, but we didn't know about that. But it was all a great experience. I was pretty young, but I suppose I could say I aged a bit quick over the 3 years that all this took. And you missed out on quite a bit of life, I suppose, when you look back at it, to what the young people have today. I mean, I can remember the day we left Alamein. That's going back on my story, isn't it? But I remember the day we left Alamein because it was my 18th birthday, and I couldn't tell anyone it was my 18th birthday because I'd have been on the first thing back home to Australia, I suppose. And then after we did the landing up at Lae, we went from there and did another landing at Finchhaven, and that was up in there, up in the top of Saddleburg, where chap I joined up with from Cranbourne, we were very good friends, went to school together and everything else, and Kevin was killed up on Saddleburg, and my 19th birthday was about 3 days after that happened. But that's just par for the course. After that, we was finished. We came back to Australia in about March, I think it was. Can't remember exactly, in 44. We had quite a long leave. We had some leave due to us, so we had about 11 weeks altogether, I think, of leave, and then went back up into Queensland to do some more training. And while I was up there, I was boarded B-class, and I didn't go to Tarakan and Balikpapan, which were the last campaigns of the war, I think. But so I missed out on those two. So that was basically my trip in the army. But I don't know.
Did you ever regret joining up as young as that?
Oh, no, I never regretted being in the army. I'll admit it had its rough patches, but my father told me when he signed the papers that I wasn't to join the infantry, so I didn't have any option. When you joined up, they just put you in the infantry anyway, but so he never ever said anything after that, because he'd been badly knocked about in the first war in the infantry anyway, so I suppose he just didn't want me to be there. But fortunately, nothing like that happened to me, but I must admit it was a wonderful education, because I was an only child, and to go away at a young age, and well, I was nearly 21 when I got out of the army, and you hardly saw anybody else except the people you were in the battalion with and all that time, except when you were home on leave. And the fellows that were a bit older than me, of course, they didn't know how old I was, but there were a few young ones like myself there. But the older ones were pretty good. They looked after us pretty well, and you learned a lot from them, talking to them. And I never regretted it one bit. I think if I had my life over again, I'd do the same thing again if I had to. And that's about it, basically.
So after the desert, you know, fighting in the desert, what did you notice about coming back and then going into the jungle training and going on to New Guinea? Was that a lot different?
No, well, I think all the fellas agreed that New Guinea would have been the worst place of anywhere that they ever were. The fellas in the unit, they all used to say that it was much worse than being in the desert. I mean, the desert was what it was, a desert and dirty and dusty and lack of water and things like that. But New Guinea, the parts we were in anyway, was something shocking. It was terrible. The fellas that went to Tarakan and Borneo that I met later on, they said it was nothing like New Guinea. It was nowhere near as hard. But it was real hard in New Guinea. There was no argument about that. I think the fellows that were on the Kokoda Trail and those things earlier on, I think they must have had a terrible time. It was bad enough for us, I know that. But it wasn't a very, very nice place.
Were you well supported and supplied? And
oh, you roughed it pretty well all the time. Sometimes we lived off the land a little bit, just make supply the rations. The rations were, well, it was limited to what you could get. You couldn't get, there was nothing fresh. You had to cook for yourselves and that sort of thing. But it was, there was nothing. You were lucky if you kept up enough cigarettes. You hoped you could. That was all you got. There was nothing else, just a few fags. And sometimes the spotter planes that used to spot for us every day would drop us cigarettes out of the plane. There were two little Australian boomerangs that used to spot for us. They were a little fighter plane made by Australia, and I don't think they ever used them in combat. They weren't, I don't know why, but we used to call them Pat and Mick, the two pilots, and they used to fly over and drop us little notes and tell us where the Japs were up the different tracks and that sort of thing. And if we were short of cigarettes, someone seemed to get a message to them, and sometimes they'd drop us out a few fags and a bit of tobacco. But they used to fly down pretty low. They could drive them like motor cars through the jungle. They were pretty good pilots.
When you were home on leave, did you notice, you know, what Australia was, how it was changing?
No, I don't. No, when I'd be home, I don't think the people in Australia really realised what would have happened had the Japanese got here. Like, from what I've read and what I've heard about it, the Battle of the Coral Sea was really an invasion fleet of Japanese coming to Australia, and the Navy ships that were involved with that Battle of the Coral Sea only accidentally, I've been told, I don't know whether that's right or not, but I've been told it was more or less an accident that they ran into the fleet. It was in the night time, and that was how that battle took place. And had that not happened, if that was true, if it was an accident when they ran into them, had that not happened and they'd invaded Australia, well, I don't know what would have happened in Australia, because, well, I think it would be the end of Australia, really, because I don't think the Japanese would have had any respect for anybody. They would have just treated everybody like they treated them anywhere else. I haven't got any love for them at all. I've got to be quite honest about that. I never could have, and I shudder to think what would have happened had they got here. Just, none of us would have been here today to enjoy it, I can tell you now. And that would have been the end of the story.
So where were you from 44 on?
Oh, well, when we went back up to Queensland, I was up in Queensland for the rest of the time, from 44 to 45.
Doing what?
Oh, still just around the camps. We just worked around the camps, did jobs. But as I say, I got out in 1945, middle of 1945. And I came home and went back to where I used to work prior to the war, which was Godfrey Phillips Cigarette Factory in Melbourne. I was born in Cranbourne and I'm still in Cranbourne. I would have probably stayed in Melbourne and lived in Melbourne after the war, but you couldn't buy a house, you couldn't get anywhere to live. It was very hard to even get anywhere to board, but fortunately where I boarded prior to the war, or prior to joining up, I went back there and they gave me a place to sleep and a couple of meals. But then when I got married at the end of 1945, I couldn't find anywhere to live at all, so the only place I could get a house was in Cranbourne. So I came back to Cranbourne and I've been here ever since.
What are your memories of Cranbourne as a child, if you don't mind going on to local history?
Oh, no.
We've still got a bit of tape to run.
Yeah, so. I know. Well, Cranbourne, when I was a young fellow, well, kiddie going to school, put it that way, there was never 100. It was usually about 95 to about 105 children attended the Cranbourne school in those days, and
really?
And possibly there might have been maybe 3 or 4 a year would go to Dandenong High School, which is the one up on the Melbourne Road there, still there today. And there'd be a couple might have gone to Caulfield Technical School. They were the two nearest other schools. I went to Caulfield Tech. As a matter of fact, I was going to Tech when the war broke out in 39. I was at Tech at that time. And, Cranbourne wasn't I don't know what the population would have been, but I didn't know the names of any of the streets in Cranbourne then. I didn't even know they had names, because if anyone pulled up and wanted to find out where someone lived, you knew where everybody lived. There were that few a number of people. So you just said, oh, he lives down there, you go down to the second corner, turn left or something, you fool, first house on the right, whatever it might have been. I've often been going to draw a little map of the township and where the houses were when I was a kiddie and who lived in them. I could remember all those sort of things, but I've never done it. But my father and mother, they came out here after the First War, and my father had bought a little farm in Devon Meadows, unseen of course, when he was in hospital in England after the First World War. And when he came out here, it was a fizzer, it was not a viable proposition, so they had to walk away and leave that. And he started up a little business, and they ran a mixed business in High Street in Cranbourne, which was open 7 days a week, and they ran that for 42 years, and it was straight opposite Kelly's Hotel in the main street.
Mm-hmm.
And that was where I lived as a child, and my mother and father ran the business. My mother did 90% of the work, I've got to be honest about that. And she worked very hard all her life and was never sick. She was always a healthy person. And there are not a lot of the old schoolmates that I went to school with left in Cranbourne now. I suppose there might be about 8 or 9 of us, and that'd be about it, really. A lot of them moved away. Cranbourne didn't have anything much for anybody to work at in Cranbourne, of course. But and then it started to grow in the middle 50s. It started to move along a little bit, and of course the last few years it's just turned into a, I don't know what you'd call it now. We call it a city, but I don't know. It's, but I still like Cranbourne. I think it's a good place to live. It's nice and handy to everything. People growl about it, but I think it's a good spot. A lot of good people around, and you can get anything you want in Cranbourne nowadays. You don't have to travel far to get what you want. And that counts a lot when you get a little bit older.
What were some of the other businesses around your parents with?
Pardon?
What were some of the other businesses in High Street?
Oh, well, in those days when I was a kiddie, we had a butcher shop next door to us. There was another one across the road next door to Kelly's Hotel. Kelly's Hotel was always there in my time. And Arthur Kelly, that's there now, well, his grandfather was Arthur Kelly, and he was the publican when I came home on leave in the army. Arthur Kelly had leased the hotel out because his son Tom had joined the Air Force. And he'd leased the hotel for 5 years. And when Tom got out of the Air Force, he went into the hotel, and he was there until such time as he passed away. And since then, Arthur and his son-in-law, Alan Stocks, they've been running the hotel ever since. I have an odd beer, and I have been served by 4 generations of Kellys in the hotel, believe it or not, from the grandfather to the grandson. And there was always a big general store on the corner opposite there, and of course Lawson's Pools Garage up on the top of the main street, that was the landmark in Cranbourne. There were 2 bakeries, Taylor Brothers owned one, and Jack Thorpe owned another. The first real estate agency in Cranbourne was Collison and Company. It was next door to my mother and father's shop. A chap named Lou Collison started it up when he came to Cranbourne. He was selling Rawley's products prior to the war. He came there when I was a kiddie, and he used to travel around the farm selling Rawley's products, and he eventually started to get into a little bit of insurance, and he was a young man. He played football for Cranbourne. Came from up at Wedderburn, and he started off Collison and Company, and he was very successful in those years in the real estate business. And the second one to start up was John Finning, or Jack Finning as we called him. He started up in Cranbourne as real estate also. Of course, I wouldn't like to think how many we got here now, but both Collison and Company and Finning are still there. But the 2 original men, John Finning and Lou Collison, of course, they've both passed away. And we also had about two motor garages. There was Lawson Pools at the top of the street, and Arthur Island had one down near where Butcher's Garage is today, near the railway station. Someone said now that we've got the electric trains going here. I always remember that someone said not long back to me, I don't know why they got the station down there, you know, it's so far from the main street, but I always remember when I was a kiddie, it was all paddocks from where the shopping complex is, that was all paddocks right down to the railway station, and people then used to say, I don't know why the station's down there, but I did hear one fellow say that they put it down there to be near the railway line, and I thought that was pretty good. But of course, people didn't think, you know, the railway line went through before the town was built. So it wasn't really the railway's fault, but no matter where you go, I think you'll find the station's always a fair way out of the main shopping centre. But Brunt's store, of course, that was always down there. The Hay and Grain store that's down near the railway crossing, that was always there, owned by Sid Brunt. They were about the main businesses in the township in those days.
But in the 1930s or so, is that what we're talking about?
Yeah, in the 30s, in the 1930s, and the 40s.
Yeah. Mm. Were you involved in any of the sporting clubs in those days?
Oh, no, my main interest, I must admit, in my life has been the RSL. Ever since the war, I've been always involved in the RSL. I've been a member there. I joined in 1943 when we came home from the Middle East. I was on leave and I was invited to go to an RSL meeting at Devon Meadows Hall, and I went there and I joined the RSL in March 1943, and I'm a life member of the Cranbourne RSL, and I'm also involved in Legacy. I'm the area leader for Dandenong West Gippsland Legacy Group. They are my main things. I was on the Cranbourne Public Hall Committee for 4 years when they started to raise the money to build the hall they've got now. I used to be on the Recreation Reserve Committee for a number of years, and the Football Club Committee for a few years, but I never played football. I didn't get really involved in anything in the sporting line. I think the years I was in the Army were the years I would have if most fellas get involved in it when they're about 18 or 17, and those years were finished for me. And when I got married in 45, I wouldn't have played footy after that, because fellas used to get knocked about and I couldn't see any sense if I didn't have an income to look after the family. So just had to battle on.
So when was the Cranbourne RSL established?
Well, the RSL sub-branch started after the First World War, of course. But it was mainly after the Second World War, when the First World War fellas all started to pass away in the 50s, 60s, because of their age. Most of them then would be getting up a bit. In the late 60s, most of them would be, 70-odd years of age. And it was mostly Second World War. There weren't very many First World War fellas left when we decided that we would do something about getting a building of our own. So we worked hard and we got a few pounds together back in the pounds days, and we purchased the land where the RSL is today, and we took about 3 years to build the first RSL building that was there. All the voluntary labour, we did the whole thing at Working Bees on Sunday mornings. I don't know how our wives put up with us, but they did. We built the RSL, and then after it was built, well, we all got a lot of pleasure out of it. We used to hold a lot of ladies' nights, and our kiddies were starting to grow up, and we used to let it out to our members for a little donation for hold a 21st birthday party for one of their family, or perhaps an engagement party as they got on, and different things like that. My mother and father had their 50th wedding anniversary there, I remember, and that was one thing. But of course then we formed a club some years later after the RSL was going, but some of the members didn't want a club. Majority did, so we formed the club, and that was that. And of course it's there today, and by all reports it's flourishing pretty well now due to the poker machines, but I suppose somebody else is suffering because of them. Well, one thing gains, another loses, I suppose. It's the way you got to look at it. But
when was the hall rebuilt? When was the hall rebuilt?
Up here?
Yeah, the RSL. When was it rebuilt?
Oh, now, as about what it is now?
Yeah.
Well, that's only been done in the last 3 years.
Oh.
Mm. Yeah, the old original part of the RSL that we built is still there. It's still part of the building. Mm-hmm. It'll be there for a few years yet, I think. It was originally weatherboard, but it got a brick front on it, and all the new extensions at the back, of course, are concrete and brick. But it's all very nice. And I don't know, we don't get as many Vietnam veterans to join the RSL as I'd like to see. I feel like there's a lot of fellas out there that should be in the RSL. It's an advantage to them to be there, I think anyway. But I don't know why they don't. Because most of the Second World War fellows now, there's not too many of them about. They're starting to thin out a bit now too. The next 5 or 6 years we'll see an enormous death rate in the Second World War veterans because of their age. I'm one of the younger ones, as I've already said, and I'm 71, nearly 71. So there's a lot of them that are 10 years older than me, and older than that again, so there won't be very many of them to carry it on very much longer.
Anything else you'd like to add about Cranbourne?
Ah, no. No, I don't think so.
Okay.